It's time to read the Des Moines Register for Thursday, July 29, 2021. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. Birthdays and announcements come at the top of the hour. We'll continue with news for another 30 minutes and then change readers. Our second shift will start with the opinion pages. Obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you would like to learn more about how you can help us keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. AccuWeather's Iowa forecast says partly sunny and humid today. A morning thunderstorm in parts of the area in the south. Very warm in the west. Less humid near Des Moines. Winds north 7 to 14 miles per hour. And here's the central Iowa forecast through the weekend. Today, a high of 94, a low tonight of 68. Very warm and humid today with clouds and sun. Winds north 7 to 14 miles per hour, partly cloudy and humid tonight. On Friday, the high will be 83, the low 68. Partly sunny and not as hot. On Saturday, look for a high of 84 and a low of 64. A stray thunderstorm or two may be in store, and it's going to be humid. On Sunday, a high of 82 and a low of 60, and possibly another stray thunderstorm. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, here are the headlines. Working to change views and grades on math, the Des Moines public school system is focusing on black male student scores. Reynolds holds out on a mask mandate, and a 25-foot American Gothic statue awaits Ragbri in Anamosa. And now, here's Linda with the first story.
Working to change views and grades on math. Des Moines Public Schools focused on black male students' scores. There is a picture here of someone named Mackie Doctor. Mackie Doctor does not remember a lot of the math he learned in high school. The 2021 Roosevelt High School graduate left school like many other black male students who feel disconnected from the math lessons meant to help them with life after school. To stave off such outcomes, the Des Moines Public Schools 3 years ago set out to change black male students' view of math and improve their Algebra 1 grades, a critical data point linked to graduation rates. Yet data released earlier this month shows the district is falling far short of its goal of increasing the percentage of black males earning at least a B in Algebra 1 by the end of their freshman year, from 17% to 35% by the 2022-23 school year. In fact, only 17% of black males taking Algebra 1 last year earned a B or higher by the end of ninth grade. In comparison, 44% of white students were earning a B or higher. Officials have long known that black males, who make up 20.5% of Des Moines' 31,621 students, are at a higher risk of being suspended, expelled, or dropping out. To help turn things around for them, the Des Moines School Board has adopted a new way of teaching math that combines focuses on theory and real-world application. And the district has started to focus more on aid to help students address needs that could be contributing to students falling short of academic goals, including food insecurity and mental health struggles. But as the district was putting these new efforts into place during the 2019 and 20 school year, the coronavirus pandemic upended schools everywhere. Now, educators across the nation and here in Des Moines are scrambling to make up for lost time. The percentage of black males earning at least a B in Algebra 1 had been trending up, but dropped in the 2019 and 20 school year when the pandemic ended in-person classes in March. The percentage climbed slightly last school year, but not enough to make up for the previous year's loss. District officials also worry that a new state law limiting discussions in public schools on certain concepts related to critical race theory may hinder their work to target needed support to black students. Critical race theory is a paradigm often taught in law schools, holding that racism infects U.S. law and policy and perpetuates a racial caste system. When Doctor took Algebra 1 as a sophomore, he questioned why he needed to know concepts like the Pythagorean theorem, a formula that helps measure a right triangle. You need this in the real world. You got to learn how to do this type of math to be successful, he said his teacher told him. I didn't have a math teacher that I could go to for help throughout high school, said Doctor, who came with his family from Ethiopia to the United States in 2006. I didn't feel comfortable at all approaching any of my math teachers. He passed the class, but the lessons did not stick. District officials want black students to leave high school as confident mathematicians. So it has changed the way it teaches math and has put an emphasis on teachers bonding with students. To do this, the district launched a new math curriculum known as Illustrative Math at the start of the 2019-20 school year. The new way of teaching is designed to build students' math identity and abilities through a balance of learning math facts and concepts and applying that learning to collaborative problem solving, said Sarah Doherty, Director of Secondary Teaching and Learning for Des Moines Schools. The approach also emphasizes building relationships between educators and students. If you actually take the time to really get to know your students first, and you make that your priority first, then you can connect them to the content rather than the other way around, said Christopher Rollins, one of the district's Talent and Support Office Transformational Leadership Coaches and an Urban Leadership Teacher at Central Campus. I think when we think around equity in math, we really want to be trying to highlight lived experiences of real issues that are going to come up within a lifespan regarding the use of math, Rollins said. District officials believe that if they can boost learning among black male students, the entire district would benefit. But the coronavirus pandemic has made the job of connecting students to math more difficult. Moving between in-person and online learning has been difficult for students and teachers alike. The shift put more pressure on math teachers because the new lessons were largely designed for in-person group work. The district is not backing down, though. We have stuck to those goals. Now, with COVID, we will be making some adjustments to those goals soon, said Des Moines School Board Chair Duana Bradley, suggesting the board could give educators more time to achieve them. Keeping the goals consistent is important because the board's aim goes deeper than improving grades, officials say. It's to change the district's culture around how students of color are viewed. Talking about race is uncomfortable for a lot of people, especially white people, said Noelle Nelson, Des Moines School's Executive Director of Teaching and Learning. We had to have an honest conversation with ourselves and own the fact that our black males, in particular, were the most underserved group. Math aside, the district continues to work on meeting students' needs, helping feed them, and providing additional mental health resources. It also continues to seek more input from students and families on school issues. It's rethinking matters such as school safety and is working to hire and retain a diverse workforce, Nelson said. We looked at all of these things that we think may be preventing achievement, and that's what's driving our strategic plan, she said. Teachers are taking part in professional development to make sure they know how to teach the new math curriculum. Additional professional development helps educators learn how to address biases and systemic racism. Once you're aware, you have a better chance of mitigating it, so that's really our approach, Nelson said. The new state law banning teaching of certain concepts, House File 802, has the district reviewing how it addresses diversity work, Nelson said. The law puts stipulations on mandatory diversity training provided to state or local government employees, as well as students and staff at school districts and public colleges. The law also includes provisions that affect the school curriculum. Republicans have said the law is a ban on critical race theory, although the law does not specifically mention that term. There is disagreement surrounding what the law does and does not ban, particularly in relation to training and curriculum at schools. The state is making it more difficult now with their new legislation. What they're calling divisive topics, we're calling equity work, Nelson said. It's just one more hurdle, but we're working through it and staying the course and planning on our data changing over time. The goal to improve black male students' performance in math stemmed from community problem-solving groups that the district organized with parents, teachers, students, and others, and from separate discussions with high school students. Social-emotional learning was a priority for a lot of students, said Des Moines School Board Vice Chair Rob Barron. I think that a lot of that really came from our students, who were reacting to what they see in the classrooms, in the hallways, and wanting a better experience. Social and emotional learning helps students understand and control their emotions and develop interpersonal skills needed for success in school and in life. The district's new approach to teaching math encompasses a whole child approach to give kids a sense of belonging in the classroom, Nelson said. As for Doctor, he found support and encouragement outside of the classroom. His mentor from the district's brother-to-brother program and his uncle pushed him to keep taking higher-level courses. This past school year, he took AP Trigonometry and earned a B. He plans to attend Iowa Western Community College in the fall.
Reynolds holds out on mask mandate. The governor wants data on CDC's response to Delta. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday she has not seen any data that would support issuing a mask mandate in response to new federal guidance that even vaccinated people in areas with high coronavirus spread should wear face coverings. Reynolds, who was quick to criticize the new CDC guidance Tuesday afternoon, was, quote, not grounded in reality, quote, said, Reynolds, who was quick to criticize the new CDC guidance Tuesday afternoon as not grounded in reality, said during a Wednesday morning news conference that she has not seen the data the CDC is basing the guidance change on, or any data that shows the effectiveness of a mask requirement in general. I haven't seen the data. They're not really forthcoming on a lot of data that they're using to make this change in the guidance, she said. And I really haven't seen any data that would support that states that don't issue a mask mandate versus states that do issue a mask mandate, that the statistics are that much different. Reynolds resisted putting a mask requirement in place for months last year, but issued a limited requirement in November as cases spiked. The requirement had many exceptions, and she lifted it in early February as case counts and hospitalizations declined and more Iowans became eligible for the vaccine. In May, Reynolds signed a law prohibiting Iowa school districts, counties, and cities from enacting their own mandates, ensuring any future requirements must come from the state level. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Tuesday altered its mask-wearing guidance due to the spread of the highly contagious Delta variant. Case numbers have begun climbing in the U.S., and rates are also climbing up in Iowa. On Wednesday, the Iowa Department of Public Health reported that COVID-19 hospitalizations had climbed to 157. Although that's far below levels seen last fall, it's more than double the number from early July. The new federal guidance recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in indoor public spaces in areas with substantial or high transmission, using words from the guidance. It also recommends that everyone inside schools should wear a mask regardless of an area's transmission. According to the CDC, 47 of Iowa's 99 counties have either substantial or high community transmission. The CDC's guidance was a change from mid-May, when the CDC had said fully vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear masks indoors or outdoors. Among the reasons the CDC has cited for the change is new data showing that vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant could spread it to others in rare cases. On Wednesday, Reynolds called the change frustrating and confusing. They're sending mixed messages constantly, she said of the CDC. They're telling Americans and Iowans, if you get a vaccine, you don't have to wear a mask. And then 2 weeks later, they changed the message on that. I think it's contradictory. Responding to a question about whether she is concerned about safety at the Iowa State Fair, which starts August 12 and annually sees approximately 1 million visitors, Reynolds said she is encouraging vaccinations and that Hy-Vee will offer some at the fair. Most people hospitalized due to COVID-19 are unvaccinated, she said. It's a decision that they've made, she said. They've made the calculation on whether or not to do it. And so I don't feel we should punish everybody because some have made the decision not to. Democrats this week said they're frustrated with Reynolds' leadership during the pandemic and with the new state law that bars cities and schools from requiring masks. Students younger than 12 are not yet eligible for vaccination. Because of the governor's failed leadership, positive cases and hospitalizations are steadily rising, and more than 6,000 Iowans have died from COVID-19, Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, a Democrat from Coralville, said Tuesday in a statement. It's time for the governor to start showing the leadership necessary to protect the lives of Iowans, especially unvaccinated children. Reynolds said Wednesday she believes Iowa's vaccination numbers are pretty good. Those are her words. According to the CDC, 49% of all Iowans are fully vaccinated, including 61% of adults. Earlier in the spring, Reynolds said her goal was to have at least 65% of Iowa adults vaccinated by the end of May and 75% by the end of June. Discussing the CDC guidelines, Reynolds said she would like to see more information on whether natural immunity in people who have already had the virus should be taken into account. I know some countries are taking a look at that, so I'd like more information from that perspective as well, she said.
Well, the other front page story is about the 25-foot American Gothic statue that is awaiting the Ragbri Riders in Anamosa. The towering pieces depict the characters in the famous painting by our native son, Grant Wood. As the world's largest annual bike ride rolls into Anamosa on Thursday, the town is planning a big welcome. In fact, it's a 25-foot tall welcome, a towering pair of statues that depict the homespun characters in native son Grant Wood's most famous painting, American Gothic. Organizers are expecting to see the statues featured in a big batch of selfies posted by cyclists riding the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa. "It's a great photo spot," said Leanne Boone, head of the Anamosa Chamber of Commerce. The statues temporarily have been erected in Wood's hometown for Ragbri in hopes that riders will help keep it there permanently. The statues, formerly known as God Bless America, were the work of prolific American sculptor Seward Johnson. Johnson, who died last year, was best known for a very different kind of sculpture, life-sized bronzes of everyday people in everyday activities. The statue in Anamosa is part of a later set of statues based on iconic images. Many are what Seward called monumental scale. The series, including the American Gothic pair, which Johnson dubbed God Bless America, has been exhibited around the U.S. and the world. The series also includes monumental scale interpretations of Marilyn Monroe in the steam grate scene from The Seven-Year Itch and The Kiss, based on the iconic photo of a sailor locking lips with a nurse in Times Square on VJ Day in 1945. While the Chicago Tribune called God Bless America a, quote, knockoff when it was exhibited there in 2009, it has won praise as well for making art accessible. Aside from being three-dimensional, it differs from Wood's original in that the painting only showed the two from the waist up. Johnson also added a suitcase covered in travel stickers at the figure's feet. Given the statue's travels, a viewer could be forgiven for taking the stickers as a literal history of where they have been. In fact, they provide a metaphorical map of places American manufacturing jobs have moved overseas. In part inspired by the statues, organizers of the Anamosa Overnight Ragbri Stop made their theme, quote, big in capital letters. The full tagline for the stop, "Size matters and we like 'em big." It was to focus on the big things we have, Boone said. Best known for being home to the Anamosa State Penitentiary, Anamosa has a long history with Ragbri, previously serving as an overnight stop in 1991, 2002, and 2012. It also has been a pass-through town. Aside from the statue, organizers point to the town's eponymous prison, also known the Big House, and its annual giant pumpkin contest as examples of the town's year-round bigness. Adding to the Ragbri festivities, giant board games and stages featuring Jones County's, quote, biggest hometown bands, Boone said. And the 15,000 plus people bedding down in town will quadruple Anamosa's not-so-big population. Wood painted the iconic image of an Iowa farmer and his daughter in 1930, inspired by a house in southeast Iowa, and it has been part of the collection of the Art Institute of Chicago ever since. Wood, who later gained fame from the painting, submitted it to an exhibition at the museum. It won the $300 third prize. That's about $5,000 in 2021 dollars. Wood grew up in Anamosa and later lived in both Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, where he taught fine arts at the University of Iowa. There is some controversy about whether the painting was intended to be a celebration of Midwestern values or a satire of them. Wood's art sometimes did both, but curators at the Art Institute have said the painting is firmly in the camp of celebration, according to art historians. Wood was born on a farm near Anamosa in 1891. He moved with his family to Cedar Rapids in 1901. His local legacy is enshrined at the University of Iowa's Grant Wood Art Colony in Iowa City, named after Wood's own Stone City Art Colony. The director of the program, a former museum curator with roots in Anamosa, has praised the statue as an important piece of Grant Wood country. Annually, I take our fellows on a tour of Grant Wood sites so they can gain a deeper understanding of Wood and Iowa. Very little physically remains of Stone City Art Colony, and it can be challenging to observe Wood's impact in this area, Maura Pilcher said in an email. Its Instagram ability is an important part of that, she said. The statue provides a photo op, and the catalyst for greater discussion, she said. Speaking of photo ops, Bond said the town is hoping that RAGBRAI riders will reach into their metaphoric pockets. Most bike shorts don't have them, and donate when they take their selfies and snapshots. The statues previously visited the town in 2018, but kept on moving. Since then, Seward's Foundation has offered to sell them to the town. Boone said, her name has been a couple ways here, it's Boone. I said Bon a minute ago. Boone said that's an important but expensive proposition. The statue has been valued at as much as $880,000. Although Boone said the price remains under negotiation, making the purchase even at a substantial discount would be a tall order for a town of 5,476 souls. We're applying for grants, of course, Boone said, but we're hoping that the riders really help us out. The statue's first visit to town provided the town a needed tourism draw, she said. We don't have exact figures, but I think you could go to any business, especially on Main Street, and I think they could tell you, Boone said. Pilcher said the value of having the statue in Anamosa goes deeper. While American Gothic is the most recognizable American painting, the image is often disconnected from its title and author, Pilcher said. The statue, in its enormity, returns the painting back into focus and reconnects it with Grant Wood.
And in another story out of the governor's office, Reynolds gives details on state troopers at the border. Nearly 30 Iowa State Patrol troopers conducted patrols, helped process immigrants, seized drugs, and disrupted human trafficking operations during their two-week deployment to the U.S.-Mexico border this month. Governor Kim Reynolds spoke about the deployment at a news conference Wednesday morning at the Iowa Department of Public Safety headquarters in Des Moines, where she invited several Iowa State Patrol leaders to share details about the mission. Reynolds was one of more than a dozen Republican governors around the country who have criticized President Joe Biden's handling of immigration and approved sending law enforcement to the border in either Texas or Arizona at the request of those states. Iowa's mission, known as Operation Lone Star, ignited a political controversy as Democrats and other critics condemned Reynolds' rhetoric about immigration and urged her to keep Iowa's law enforcement officials in the state. Reynolds announced in June that she had approved sending Iowa State Patrol troopers to the U.S.-Mexico border at Texas' request. A total of 28 troopers were deployed to the Del Rio area in southwest Texas for 14 days this month. They traveled to Texas on July 8 and returned July 22. I made this decision because the federal government has abdicated its duties, she said. Texas law enforcement and border agents are being overwhelmed, and the crisis at the border isn't staying at the border. It's being felt across the country, including right here in Iowa. And Reynolds left open the possibility of sending more Iowa law enforcement to the U.S.-Mexico border in the future, depending on what the needs are there and in Iowa. Her actions drew a rebuke from Democrats later Wednesday. Araceli Good and Patricia Ritchie, the chair and vice chair of the Iowa Democratic Party's Latinx caucus, issued a statement criticizing what they described as Reynolds' hurtful and dangerous rhetoric. We are grateful to the Iowa State Patrol for their professionalism at the U.S.-Mexico border and happy to see them home and safe, they said. However, Governor Reynolds and the Iowa Republicans continue to use fear to divide us from each other when they know, just like we do, that people who were born here are far more likely to commit crimes than people who are immigrants. This rhetoric is hurtful, dangerous, and normalizes hateful actions toward Iowa's Latinx community. Joe Henry, state political director of the League of United Latin American Citizens in Iowa, said Reynolds' comments about offering humanitarian aid stand in contrast to her remarks about securing the border. She acknowledged most people fleeing violence are in need of our assistance, but then the governor flips the conversation to state that she wants to secure the border and prevent criminals, drugs, and human traffickers from entering, he said. Which is it? How can we refuse humanitarian aid and shut the door to those seeking refuge at the same time? Governor, you can't do both unless you are playing politics with the lives of victims, he said. The cost of the mission is estimated at just under $300,000, said Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Bayens, although he acknowledged the final numbers are still in flux. That includes about $50,000 for food, lodging, vehicle rentals, and some equipment, about $150,000 in overtime pay, and about $100,000 in salary, which the Iowa State Patrol would also have paid if the troopers were on duty in Iowa. They did Iowa proud, Bayens said. I mean, they brought Iowa values to Texas. They worked hard when hard work was required. They showed compassion when compassion was needed, and I'm proud of them. And I know the people of Texas appreciated it. Reynolds said earlier this month that Iowa expects to pay the cost of the mission. She said Wednesday that it's likely still the case, although there is some possibility that federal funds could be used for some of the costs. But she said the costs of the mission were worth it because of the impact, she said, lax border security had on Iowa, including resulting in increased drug trafficking in the state. It is an investment that I believe is well spent in helping really secure the southern border and the humanitarian efforts that were put in place, she said. I felt that it was the right thing to do. The Iowa law enforcement officers who traveled to the border included 12 Iowa State Patrol road troopers, 12 tactical operators, 3 command staff, and a bilingual investigative agent. The troopers were deployed to Texas under an Emergency Management Assistance Compact that allows states to assist each other in times of disaster or emergency. Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Arizona Governor Doug Ducey last month asked for their colleagues around the country to send law enforcement officers to help at the border. Their 4 duties at the border were to accompany Texas law enforcement in conducting high-visibility patrols in the Del Rio area, engage in humanitarian efforts at the border, disrupt criminal networks, and investigate human smuggling, Bayens said. The law enforcement operations that Iowa troopers assisted with resulted in 240 criminal arrests, 51 vehicle pursuits, and the seizure of 948 pounds of marijuana, 37 pounds of cocaine and methamphetamine, 18 firearms, and $1.7 million, said Iowa State Patrol Colonel Nathan Fulk. Troopers also provided food, water, and other aid to more than 800 undocumented immigrants at the U.S. border fence and encountered 184 people crossing the Rio Grande River. Reynolds has stressed the impact of drug trafficking on Iowa as one reason for sending troopers to the border. From January through May, she said, Iowa saw a more than 1,100% increase in fentanyl seized, 6,641 grams, compared to 523 grams during the same time period in 2020. A news release from the governor's office said Customs and Border Protection statistics show 93% of heroin found in the country was originally smuggled across the U.S.-Mexico border. Iowa State Patrol Captain Mark Miller, who led the deployment, said he believes Iowa's law enforcement officers accomplished their objectives of protecting U.S. citizens from crime, keeping immigrants safe, and disrupting criminal activities. Your Iowa troopers and special agents met their mission objectives, he said. They performed both law enforcement and humanitarian functions, and they represented the state of Iowa in a way that you can be extremely proud of. The troopers who participated in that deployment were all volunteers. They account for about 8% of the Iowa State Patrol's roughly 360 sworn officers.
Turning to the Metro section, here's an article. Iowa's COVID-19 hospitalizations doubled in July. COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to jump as the coronavirus resurges across Iowa, according to weekly data released by the Iowa Department of Public Health on Wednesday. The number of Iowans hospitalized with COVID-19, which was in the 70s for much of the first half of July, has reached 157. The numbers of Iowans in intensive care units, 54, and on ventilators, 20, are also increasing. New reported cases are also climbing sharply in Iowa. The state is now averaging 308 new cases per day, up from 63 less than 3 weeks ago. Jennifer Ellis, a spokesperson for Unity Point Health Des Moines, said there were a total of 23 COVID-positive patients hospitalized at Iowa Methodist Medical Center and Iowa Lutheran Hospital Wednesday. Just a couple of weeks ago, the two hospitals were seeing about 5 to 8 such patients, Ellis said. It was feeling so good, Ellis said. Of all the COVID inpatients the two Des Moines hospitals have treated since March 19th, only 7% have been fully vaccinated, she said. Also, all of the fully vaccinated people who were hospitalized there for COVID were older than 60 and had compromised immune systems, and only one of them needed to be taken to the intensive care unit. In addition to COVID-positive patients, hospitals also have routinely been treating inpatients who are no longer testing positive for the virus but are still suffering serious effects from bouts with COVID-19, Ellis said. Some of these patients may still be in the ICU on a ventilator because of the lasting damage COVID did to their lungs, she said. Others wind up spending substantial time in hospital rehabilitation units, trying to regain their strength after they're no longer counted as COVID patients on official tallies, she said. Ellis said her Des Moines hospital system's total of 23 official COVID inpatients is nowhere near the 150 it had during Iowa's peak outbreak last fall. But many hospitals are currently jammed with other kinds of patients, including children and adults contending with respiratory diseases, such as RSV or pneumonia, which normally are uncommon in summer. She said the hospitals will be stretched if the COVID numbers continue to climb. The University of Iowa Hospitals in Iowa City reported it had 12 COVID inpatients on Tuesday, up from 3 2 weeks earlier. Iowa's increases come as the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued new guidance Tuesday recommending that even fully vaccinated people resume wearing masks indoors in high transmission areas. The Iowa Department of Public Health on Wednesday, July 28th, was reporting a total of 378,831 coronavirus cases in Iowa since the start of the pandemic, an increase of 2,158 over the previous week. In the past 7 days, Iowa has reported an average of 308 new cases each day. At noon Wednesday, the state had not yet reported any additional deaths from COVID-19. It typically takes at least a week after a death for the state to report it, so zero reported deaths does not indicate that no Iowans died from COVID-19 in the past week. There have been 6,170 confirmed COVID-19 deaths in Iowa. A total of 1,479,084 Iowans, or 47% of Iowa's population, were fully vaccinated as of Wednesday, having received either both doses of a two-dose sequence or one dose of a single-dose vaccine. Another 93,863 Iowans, or 3%, were partially vaccinated with the first dose of a two-dose sequence. The latest data as of 10 a.m. Wednesday, July 28th, compared to the previous Wednesday. Confirmed cases, 378,831, an increase of 2,158. Deaths, 6,170, unchanged from July 21st. The total tested, 1,826,331. The total recovered, 368,102. And the statewide 14-day positivity rate, 5.7%. Other statistics, hospitalizations, 157, up from 101 1 week ago. Patients in ICU, 54, up from 31. Patients on ventilators, 20, up from 12. So in total for Polk and Dallas counties, in Polk County, 272,795 people, or 56% of residents, have received at least one dose of the vaccine. 252,913, or 52%, are fully vaccinated, an increase of 2,042, or 0.4 percentage points, since last week. In Dallas County, 51,542 people, or 55% of residents, have received at least one dose. 48,243, or 52%, are fully vaccinated, an increase of 347, or 0.4 percentage points, which is very similar to Polk County. The five counties in Iowa with the highest percentage of their population fully vaccinated as of July 28th are Johnson at 59%, Lynn at 53%, Dubuque at 52%, Boone 52%, and Dallas 52% counties. For a county-by-county look at the vaccination rollout, you can look at the COVID-19 vaccine tracker, which is updated weekly.
A couple make Gravel Day one to remember. Wedding marks new beginnings at the end of the gravel loop. It didn't take long for a long, smooth track to be worn into the dusty gravel roads coming out of Fort Dodge. Hundreds of riders split from the mainstream of cyclists about 10 miles into day 3 of Ragbri 48 to take a ride on the first gravel day. The route was optional and ran just north of the 55-mile road route for the day. Among the riders opting for the more challenging route on Tuesday, Des Moines residents Cole Ledbetter and Kelsey Urich. Ever since they met 3 years ago, they've been riding bikes on gravel and drinking beer together. We both grew up riding gravel as kids, Ledbetter said. A 7-year RAGBRAI veteran, Ledbetter started the Iowa Gravel Project Facebook page as a resource for cyclists looking to get off the road, and said Urich has been there every step of the way as the sport has exploded in popularity. The pair regularly go on gravel rides together or support one another on rides when needed. A gravel loop has been a staple of the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa for years, but Ledbetter had long hoped it would become a full-day option. As plans fell into place for the route under new ride director Dieter Drake, a veteran gravel racer, so too did wedding plans for the couple. A big, expensive wedding was something neither one wanted. My only other thought would have been to elope, Urich said, but added that neither her parents nor Ledbetter's would have been too thrilled with that idea. Choosing the first full-day gravel RAGBRAI ride for the ceremony was very mutual, Ledbetter said. So, covered in 70 miles of gravel dust and with smiles from ear to ear, Ledbetter and Urich rolled into Alden, he with a blue bow tie on his helmet and she wearing a veil and a garter. Rumors of a wedding on RAGBRAI had been spreading, so the shady park nestled along the rolling Iowa River was packed with riders and bikes. Ledbetter waited, wearing a hand-knit tie from Urich at a small white gazebo overlooking the river, and the 50 or so riders who had jumped in it to swim. The sea of riders who remained on shore parted, and on the arm of her father, Urich proceeded down the sidewalk, taking her place opposite the groom in front of the gazebo. I typically would be very nervous standing in front of so many people, but Cole was right there, and it was the happiest place in the world, Urich said. As the vows were read, the couple mixed jars of gravel for their respective homes into a beer stein. Bob Rasmus, a fellow gravel cyclist who became a minister for the occasion, performed the ceremony. I told them to focus on loving each other, uphill, downhill, whatever the case may be, and when they look at that jar of rocks, that's what they should think about, Rasmus said. Sniffles from the crowd could be heard in an exchange of rings, a kiss, and a long hug brought the event to a close. The unexpectedly large group of spectators raised their arms, and newly married couples exited through a tunnel of spandex and beer glasses. We had such an incredible morning, getting to ride our bikes and just be us, and then this, it's just so great, Urich said. I can't imagine anything better than this. 4 more days of riding await the newlyweds as they make the journey to Clinton. The rest of the week should be filled with beer and fun, Ledbetter said, a great way to end the week after the wedding.
And here's a story. Slipknot band drummer, founding member, Des Moines native Joy Jordison dies at 46. Slipknot founding member and original drummer Joey Jordison died Monday. He was 46. Des Moines native Jordison and a group of friends from the area started the chart-topping metal band in 1995. Jordison played with Slipknot for nearly 2 decades before his departure in 2013. Joey's death has left us with empty hearts and feelings of indescribable sorrow, Jordison's family said in a statement to Rolling Stone. To those that knew Joey, understood his quick wit, his gentle personality, giant heart, and his love for all things family and music. The family of Joey have asked that friends, fans, and media understandably respect our need for privacy and peace at this incredibly difficult time. The family will hold a private funeral service. A rep for his family told Rolling Stone that Jordison died peacefully in his sleep, but didn't specify the cause of his death. The magazine reported he had developed transverse myelitis, a debilitating neurological disease. Jordison was also the guitarist for horror punk band Murder Dolls, and most recently played drums for metal band Vimic. He grew up in Des Moines, the eldest of three children, and began playing drums at age 8. Jordison was already a veteran of the city's metal scene when he founded the band that would become Slipknot in 1995, along with percussionist Sean Crahan and bassist Paul Gray. The three talked plans and concepts for the band in sessions at the gas station where Jordison worked. Slipknot founding member Joy Jordison traveled the world with the iconic heavy metal band, but his heart remained in his hometown of Des Moines. He told the Register during a 2016 interview, "I couldn't be more proud to be from a city that's given me so much," Slipknot's original drummer told the Register before he debuted his latest band, Vimic, a heavy metal band for which he also played drums. Jordison, 46, died Monday, according to a statement from his family. A cause of death has not been released. A Des Moines native, Jordison was a founding member of Slipknot in 1995. He played with them for nearly two decades before his departure in 2013. In 2016, Jordison revealed that his absence was due in part to acute transverse myelitis, a spinal cord inflammation that he began treatment for a year prior to leaving Slipknot. Before debuting Vimic in Des Moines in 2016, Jordan spoke to the Register. Below is an edited version of the interview. So the question from the Register, what's it like to get back behind the kit after what you went through with your health? And he says, "You know, I don't think about the health too much anymore because I beat it all. I'm healthier than I've been. I know a lot of people try to portray this like, oh, I've got to sell myself to promote the show or something like that. But that's absolutely the truth. It took me a long time to recover from what I had to go through. So to actually launch the Vimic campaign here in my hometown, there could not be a better place to do it. If I did it somewhere else, it wouldn't feel as right." Question, what drives you to keep doing music? "It's a tough thing. Here's how I can explain it to you. It never leaves. It's a fire. No matter how much water on it or how much I try and rest, it will not burn out. It's constant. The more that I write, the more people I write with or people I exchange music with, it keeps burning brighter. It's a flame that is constant and it's going to go for a while. It will not burn out. My love for music and life in general and creating new things and going into different areas, always trying to do something different in terms of my artistic ability, that's what my passion of music is about. I'm always trying to go to a new zone." Question, with everything you just said, was there ever a time after the illness or Slipknot that you thought you were never going to play again? "Nah, that never crossed my mind. There's one thing I want people to understand about the illness. It's kind of like answering a dead horse all the time. People, I guess, need to know, especially this being a hometown. I wouldn't wish this on anyone. The fact that I was ever able to come out of it, I came back stronger than I ever had through determination and through the right people. Hitting the gym constantly, I had the determination to beat it. It's almost the same determination that made me want to play music in the first place. Like, I'm going to do this, it's going to happen. And right now, everything's good." The last question, what's it mean for you to come back and open this band in Des Moines? His answer, one thing I say about Des Moines is, you can leave Des Moines, but Des Moines will never leave you. It's a special place. I've been around the world, man. I've been damn near everywhere you can possibly be, except for a couple places. But I still live here. I will not move. This is where my heart's at. I couldn't be more proud to be from a city that's given me so much.
And the hot air balloon solos over Indianola in preparation for the National Balloon Classic. This solo balloon flight over Indianola on Monday, July 19th, would be a hint of things to come. The 50th National Balloon Classic opens in the skies on Friday, June 30th. This year's event will commemorate 50 years of ballooning in Indianola, with a vintage balloon inflation to kick off the event Friday at the Memorial Balloon Field, located at 15335 Jewell Street in Indianola. The event runs through Saturday, August 7, with daily flying competitions and other entertainment. Tickets must be purchased in advance online at nationalballoonclassic.com or from the Indianola Hy-Vee. Tickets cannot be scanned from a mobile phone or any other electronic device. So you'll want to be prepared if you're going to go to the Classic.
I'll start an article here, see how long I get. The article is about the missing boy in Montezuma. Where is Javier? The 11-year-old boy disappeared 2 months ago. Tuesday marked 2 months since Javier Harrelson disappeared from his Montezuma home on May 27th, and still there's no trace of him. His family, along with advocates for the 11-year-old boy, want to know why an Amber Alert hasn't been issued related to his disappearance. They believe it could give his case a wider reach and help bring the boy home, but they worry 2 months after the fact it might be too late to make a difference. We don't want people to forget or give up on him. All it takes is one person to see his face and call in a tip, and hopefully bring him home, Javier's aunt, Michelle Harrelson, said Tuesday. The Amber Alert is a very good system, but it could be better. And so Harrelson, 36, of Marshalltown, is trying to make it better. For an Amber Alert to be issued in Iowa, law enforcement must confirm a child under 18 has been abducted. The case also must meet other criteria. Law enforcement has to believe the circumstances surrounding the child's abduction indicates that the child is in danger of serious bodily harm or death, and there needs to be enough description of the child and their abductor or a suspect's vehicle to broadcast. But in Javier's case, there has been no tipping point in the investigation, no evidence to indicate any foul play in his disappearance. Investigators say they aren't ruling anything out, including abduction, but nothing has been confirmed. Kids don't just disappear into thin air, Harrelson said. Harrelson has started a petition to change the Amber Alert criteria to include children who, like Javier, are missing, but abduction has not been confirmed. Nearly 2,500 people have signed the petition as of Tuesday afternoon. And she's just beginning drafting legislation with the help of a friend, Diane Hoffman. Javier Orr fell through the cracks and we lost even more time searching for him, said Hoffman, who is a certified paralegal from Indianola. Hours and days were lost, crucial hours and days, Hoffman said. Every hour, every day that goes by, the chances are slimmer. Hoffman couldn't finish her sentence through tears. Harrelson and Hoffman are considering naming the bill Javier's Bill or Javier's Law in honor of the Montezuma boy. But their hope for the bill is that it won't just bring Javier home, but all missing children, they say, have fallen through the cracks of the Amber Alert's current criteria. Even if Javier was home right now, I'd still be doing this. There's thousands and thousands of kids we don't know about, faces we haven't seen, Harrelson said. If I can't change the Amber Alert criteria, then I want to create a new one. Harrelson suggested a new alert could be named an Orange Alert, Javier's favorite color. Leamy Kong Sofer, the director of case management at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, said the Amber Alert was designed to have the public's eyes and ears on a missing child's case. That's why media attention is also important, she said. Javier was supposed to celebrate his 11th birthday on Sunday, May 30th, just 3 days after he went missing, with his dad's side of the family in Marshalltown.